The unsurpassed, penetrating, and perfect truth is seldom met with 100,000 myriad kalpas. Now we can see and hear it. We can remember and accept it. I vow to make the Buddha's truth one with myself. Homage to the Buddha, homage to the Dharma, homage to the Sangha. Well, thanks for coming to join us today for this, what we call the Festival of Remembrance on Memorial Day. And we celebrate this, of course, to honor and to transfer merit, as you heard from our practice, for the benefit of all those who died as a result of wars, whether they were fighting or not. All the wars, past and present, all beings are included, no matter what side they were on, humans, soldiers, civilians, all the animals, the many animals, big and small, who perished in the tragedy of wars and who are dying now as a result of war. So we offer merit for them, and also, of course, express our gratitude for their sacrifice, those who have died protecting our country and our people. And I have to say, on this day, I always find my own thoughts on these kinds of occasions turning toward how we can prevent war and serious conflict with others. Reverend Master Jiyu, as you may have heard, has said that the level of sanity in a society goes increasingly downward when people go to war with each other. And the worse the wars get, the lower the level of sanity is. So that's the general perspective of Buddhism. It doesn't mean that Buddhists haven't gone to war. Sometimes they felt it necessary. But nonetheless, one should be aware that one is entering into something that is somewhat insane. And sometimes Buddhists have felt it's the lesser of evil, so that's an individual choice as far as whether one goes into the military or not. Of course, there are still consequences to killing others, and each person will bear the consequences of that. My own experience growing up, I was the child of a German family who emigrated to Canada right after the war in 1951, and certainly that situation raised a lot of deep questions in me as a child. My parents were in their early 20s and wanted to get away from all of that and start a new life. And of course we were, I think from the age of 12, we had television in northern BC where I grew up. And of course there were still a lot of war movies on the TV. And I always found them a little confusing because all the German people came across as brutes and bullies, which many were, of course. And, you know, demoralized and so on and so forth, just because that was American TV at the time. Of course, it changed over time, and the complexities of war and the whole situation are being brought to light more in more intelligent films. But nonetheless, it was hard, you know. And I knew lots of German people in that town who were immigrants, and they were very nice people. So clearly, it wasn't something that had to do with nationality necessarily, but in this case a nation joined together and perpetuated as a nation a lot of evil, right? And nonetheless, those questions were valuable. I couldn't articulate them as a child. I could barely talk about them with my parents, but they eventually are a big part of what brought me to Buddhist training, the search for what's at the heart of this. Why do people have this sort of conflict with each other, and what's the cause of these, this kind of suffering, this kind of evil? And it took me eventually, among other difficulties I had as a child and a teenager, to really looking to the root of suffering, looking to, you know, what's at the heart of this really? And I was very glad when I connected with Buddhist training. I happened to be living in Europe, in London at the time. I'd done a little exploration in psychological stuff, but when I hit Buddhism and meditation practice, something opened up for me. It was like a completely open pathway. And I had this sense, oh, there actually is a way. There is a way of peace. I had no idea what that really was, but it was different from all the other things that I had learned, even regarding morality or psychology and so on, which all at that point were helpful but a little limited. So that I realized there was something eternal and that Buddhist training would help take me there. So those are some of my early experiences. So in reflecting on, you know, what creates peace actually, what can we do as individuals to help? As you know, the Buddha always brought us back to our own training and our own attitude of mind. So these reflections take me to the essentials of Shakyamuni Buddha's teachings again. Shakyamuni was really a great master of peace. When you read all the sutra stories and so on, he comes out as somebody who knew how to create peace, he was at peace with himself, but he also knew how to bring people together and how to help people go beyond opposites and conflict. And yet he was not a god, he was a person, and occasionally he didn't succeed, but he did such a remarkable job of that in his, you know, mere 80 years of life. And of course, we're still practicing that today. All that he discovered to be true for himself on the night of his enlightenment led him to the source of peace. And then he spent the rest of his life teaching others, pointing to the way to finding that peace within ourselves and how to live in harmony with each other. And so he taught, unless we have a peaceful heart, it's impossible to live peacefully with others. So as Buddhists, we always come back to looking at our own mind, as you know, our own attitude of mind and heart when dealing with conflict. One thing that came to me as I was thinking about this talk is the essential teachings of the Buddha, one of which I'm very fond of, on the chief characteristics of our existence, sometimes called the three characteristics, but in the Mahayana tradition we sometimes have four of them. If one really reflects on these teachings and takes them seriously from our own experience, they lead us to a heart of peace. So I'd like to just look at the way of peace, if you like, in light of the characteristics of existence. Well, the first one is dukkha, suffering. Suffering exists for all peoples, as we know, all beings, and we can't really do anything about ourselves until we connect with that within ourselves. And so once we do that, we begin to see and appreciate the suffering of others. And this is huge with regards to being motivated to avoid doing harm and conflicting with others. In the Buddha's last teachings, towards the end of the scripture on the Buddha's last teachings, one of his chief disciples, the Aniruddha Buddha, says to him, O world-honored one, the moon can make us hot and the sun can be cold to us. The Buddha has told us that the Four Noble Truths should not make us different from each other. The Buddha has also told us that the reality of the truth of suffering is that suffering, which is the inability to make ourselves happy, exists. And I would say, I find that a really intriguing statement. It was very simple. The inability to make ourselves happy, or basically, the inability to make ourselves peaceful. I like to look at it that way, because happiness is a word that has lots of interpretations in our world. But the inability to be peaceful within ourselves, no matter what's going on, that this exists. And of course, this brings us to training, that the reality of the defiling passions, greed, anger, delusion, is the cause of that suffering, and that this cause is not different for any of us. No one is excluded from this. That if suffering is extinguished, then this cause is extinguished, because when a cause is eliminated, its fruits are also eliminated. So just to emphasize this point of the importance of coming back to focusing on doing something about ourselves, our own greed, anger, and delusion as being the source of finding peace. And in my own experience, just reflecting and and truly accepting the fact of suffering, both my own and the suffering of others, gives rise to compassion and loving kindness. It just comes forth. You don't have to create that compassion. It's just part of our true nature. And when we accept it fully and reflect on it and look carefully at what's going on with others, that compassion and loving kindness arises. And of course, again, the motivation to do harm and be in conflict with others then is dispelled. Then the other characteristic of existence is anicca, which is the law of change or impermanence. As you know, everything being in a constant state of flux. You know, even science has proved that every particle of our being is, and of all existence, is in a constant state of flow. There's nothing ultimately, when you reflect on this, to grasp onto and to keep forever. There's nothing we can keep, no thing that we can keep forever. And when you really think about it deeply, nothing really that we can be attached to. And of course we try, and when we try to cling to things and people, we suffer. Yeah. As we're then trying to set up something outside of this, what I experience as a natural universal flow of Buddha nature. So when we try to cling to some part of that, we just sort of try to pull ourselves out of that flow. It doesn't work, it doesn't feel good. We feel we have to possess things and strengthen a false sense of self that then has to be protected, and then that, you know, we build on that. So reflections on impermanence are very helpful also for creating peace within ourselves and without. This is a useful little book here, which many of you may have read, An Introduction to Buddhist Ethics by Peter Harvey. It's a compilation of all sorts of teachings of the Buddha and masters, well-known masters after that, with regards to all sorts of issues, but just in terms of the section on war and peace, many interesting quotes and reflections. Here's one from the great master Buddha Gosa. He suggests that one should reflect on impermanence with regards to preventing war and acknowledge that the mind states of a person who has harmed one are likely to be different now from when he or she did the harmful act. Of course, this applies even more to the actions of a past generation of a country or group that was once seen as an enemy. In other words, it loosens our grip on our opinions about others, our judgments about others. Again, one can even see an annoying person in terms of a collection of physical elements and mental processes, i.e. the skandhas. Which particular part, in quotes, of them is one annoyed with? Yeah. If you think about that carefully, you know, if you break it down, what am I annoyed with? And of course, we that's a whole other Dharma talk. Often that has something to do with what we're annoyed with within ourselves. One may also reflect on the inspiring example of the Buddha in past lives when he showed great patience at provocation, or reflect on the 11 kinds of good results of the mind deliverance by loving kindness, and so on and so forth, such as good sleep without disturbing dreams, the good regard of others, a serene face, a kind expression, and an easily concentrated mind. If all else fails, it is useful to give a gift to or receive one from a person to whom one is hostile. So these are teachings from the Buddha. Not easy to do, but there are stories in our contemporary, even on the news, that you hear about people doing this. There was some sort of anti-Muslim demonstration somewhere, and there's a doctor who is very is really trying to create better communication between Americans and Muslims and so on. And he decided rather than counter-demonstrating and yelling at the people who were demonstrating and yelling, he brought some food and offered the head guy who was protesting some Middle Eastern food and had a nice conversation with him. You know, it's like there are things we can do, you know, to diffuse. But, you know, it's such an interesting quote, what part of the person am I annoyed with? What part of the people am I annoyed with? A further teaching here from Shantideva, a great Mahayana writer who wrote The Way of the Bodhisattva, he says, why be unhappy about something if it can be remedied? All right? And what is the use of being unhappy about something if it cannot be remedied? There's a further reflection there. So these can really take one out of, if you're feeling stuck in anger or conflict with someone, or just having a lot of negative thoughts about something that's going on in our world today, some of these things, reading some of these teachings, can just take the mind away from the attachment to those negative emotions. Very effective. Then we have the teaching, one of the characteristics of existence, as you know, is called anatta. No self, no separate self, no soul, no ultimate permanent soul. The Buddha taught that this, you know, he was teaching in response in part to this idea that there's a permanent soul that goes from, it's reincarnated from one life to another, takes on a different body. But the Buddha's teaching is a little different. So there's ultimately no separate self to protect or to defend or to fight against. Personally, I find that the Buddha's teaching on this no separate permanent soul or self, or another way of saying it is that a selfish self can't ultimately exist or survive, yeah, because one is creating something unreal when we're being selfish. Yeah, does that make sense? Yeah, that makes sense. So I find that this teaching, this particular aspect of characteristic of existence, to be foremost in helping me to find peace and to live at peace with others. And of course, it's a work in progress. I have to say, all these things are training in progress for me, certainly. But I'll share a little bit of my experience there. Reverend Master Jiyu, a quote that, you know, something she said to me, certainly, and I has stuck with me and is very helpful, many times it's been very helpful, would say, where there's hurt, there's a self. Where there's hurt, there's self. And my experience is this is very true. It doesn't mean that we don't get hurt, that you know, sometimes abuse doesn't happen and so on and so forth. But what we do at the point of feeling hurt is very, very significant. And, you know, my experience is, and it's, you know, we just have knee-jerk reactions, you know, when we're inexperienced in training. But as we go on, we begin to see more and more how reacting out of hurt can do a great deal of harm. And my theory is that, you know, many wars, major wars, are probably started from hurt feelings, you know? How often do people feel hurt about something? Because of poverty, because of lack, deprivation, differences of point of view, being put down, whatever it might be, and then lashing out, you know, feeling they have to counter it in some way. It's very interesting if you examine it, but if you just look at it within yourself, you can see the seeds. Of course, we're not creating wars on a daily basis, I hope none of you, but the seeds are there, and it's really, really helpful to catch those and to know that our training makes a difference, that we can find peace even in the midst of all the turmoil and chaos around us. So essentially, personally, I find just being still with the hurt feeling. And I have to say, if it's any comfort to you, as you go on in training, it gets easier to do. It's not easy, ever, but it's easier to do as we go on, just to be still with the hurt feeling, just to hold it, just to embrace it. It's talking to us. It's, you know, essentially it's our Buddha nature talking to us and telling us, okay, it's a piece of karma that needs cleaning up, something that we need to deal with, but it's not all there is of you, and it's held within the Buddha nature. But these feelings of hurt, feelings of being misunderstood, feelings of being offended, just to sit still with those. And again, of course, this highlights the importance of our meditation practice. Without the meditation practice, it's very, very difficult to learn to do this in daily life, you know, to just be still when something hits us. But as we go on, we see more and more of the choices that we have. We see that we can choose to react, or we can sit still. Or if we have reacted, we, at some point, if we're meditating, we see, okay, that wasn't a good reaction. It has resulted in suffering. The other person is even more upset with me, and so on and so forth. So very, very significant, I think, what we do with hurt feelings. And in the end, you know, when we work through one of these, we realize that there actually is no, there wasn't a self there to defend in the first place. And something opens up. It creates a space. Something gets cleaned up when we do that. And when we do that, it changes our relationships. It may take time. You know, some of us have a reputation for doing certain things, and, you know, that reputation may follow us for most of our lives. But if we're fortunate enough to live in a religious community, to have a sangha where people are meditating, where they are aware of impermanence, they will appreciate the changes that you make. But whether people do or not, you will feel differently. You will know the difference. You will find peace. And particularly revengeful feeling that comes out of hurt feeling is very important to sit still with. It never does any good. It's understandable. We can have compassion for ourselves, but it never does any good. Here's a small little piece of we chanted this invocation, what is it called? Simma's Questions, about General Simma, who was a general at the time of the Buddha and came to the Buddha for teaching. In fact, when you read the whole sutra, the whole story, Simha was a very well-known general, and he was a follower of another religious sect called the Nigantas. And the chief of that sect, Nataputta, well, many of these sects did not necessarily have a high regard for the Buddha at that time. And the Buddha did have many struggles, by the way. But Simha kept hearing about this wonderful teacher, so he wanted to go and see him, but this other teacher kept discouraging him. But finally he said, I've just got to do it. I'm just hearing so many good things. So he went, and you know, the other teacher was saying the Buddha teaches annihilation. He teaches there are no consequences to actions, etc., etc., all these things. So the Simha goes to him and says, well, what about all this? You know, what's true? What do you teach? Interestingly, the reason I want to bring this up is it's another aspect of the story. The way that the Buddha initially responds to Simha is very interesting. He says, the Blessed One said, there is a way, Simha, in which one who says so is speaking truly of me in response to the criticisms. There is a way in which those who say so are speaking truly of me. On the other hand, Simha, there's a way in which one who says the opposite is speaking truly of me too. Very skillful answer, as I say, as an example. I don't always have the wherewithal to come up with something as calm and centered as that. But, you know, it's such a good example, and it's so true, you know. So he might have a hurt feeling. I don't know what he was feeling, but he's not acting on it, right? So he says, listen, and I will tell you. And so he then starts to clarify, goes through all the things that the criticisms refer to, you know. So just as an example, he says, I teach Simha the not do, because he's been criticized for teaching non-action and thus being immoral, you know. So he says, I teach Simha, so he uses all of those criticisms and weaves them into what he actually teaches to bring out the truth. It's very interesting. I teach Simha the not doing of such actions as are unrighteous. So he's not just teaching non-action, he's teaching the not doing of such actions as are unrighteous, either by deed or by word or by thought. I teach the not bringing about of all those conditions of heart which are evil and not good. However, I teach Simha the doing of such actions as are righteous by deed, by word, and by thought, and so on and so forth. And he goes on, as far as annihilation goes, in response to that that criticism. He says, I proclaim, Simha, the annihilation of egotism, of lust, of ill will, of delusion, not a complete annihilation. However, I do not proclaim the annihilation of forbearance, of love, of charity, and of truth. Interesting response, isn't it? I deem, Simha, unrighteous actions contemptible. Yeah, there also he was criticized for being contemptible and so on. So he addresses all these things and brings the truth out. So I found that to be a very interesting example. And of course, Simha, as he hears this, he says, wow, yeah, you know, truly you are the Buddha, and he wants to be his lay disciple. And this is a very renowned person in the area, very well-known, famous general. And, you know, the Buddha doesn't immediately say, oh, great, I've got this, you know, famous person now as my disciple. On the contrary, he says, well, consider first, Simha, after he first asks, what you're doing. Is it becoming that persons of rank like yourself should do something, do nothing, you know, so without due consideration? In other words, think about your rank and who you are, and when you make this decision to be my disciple, how is it going to affect others, and so on. So he doesn't immediately, you know, accept him. Then Simha asks again, you know, because he's really taken with the Buddha and wants to take refuge with him, and so on. And so the Buddha says, for a long time, so he asks three times, and the Buddha says, for a long time, Simha, you've made offerings. Offerings have been given to the Nigantas, this other sect that was criticizing the Buddha, in your house. You've been giving offerings to them. So you should therefore deem it right also in the future to continue to give them food when they come to you on alms pilgrimage. So that's interesting. He insisted that he continue to make offerings to them, even though they were critical of him, because, you know, he was looking at the greater good for all involved. So Simha's heart was filled with joy, of course, because, for obvious reasons, the generosity, the selflessness that the Buddha demonstrated there. So that's just another aspect of that story that I think is very interesting and shows, again, how to create peace. So he didn't take this famous person as his disciple and, you know, I'm the only one you can give alms to, but he encouraged him to continue to be generous and be careful about how he went about with this decision. Going back to thinking about hurtful feelings and how they cause problems, I saw something some time back, a story about a great Sufi master in the 1200s in Turkey, and he quoted, it's funny how you watch, you know, you can watch a 10-part series of something and one line of teaching jumps out at you and stays with you. Well, this is the one that stayed with me the most. Of course, some of the subtitles, some of the translation was a little difficult in this too, but he quoted a particular ancient Sufi master who talked about not wasting his strength on being offended. He didn't want to waste his strength on being offended. I thought, oh, something about that I need to pay attention to. Now, that doesn't mean that, you know, perhaps offense isn't intended sometimes, but again, what I do with that. And it's been an interesting reflection for me. How much energy and time do I put into feelings of being offended and then the consequent, you know, feeling I have to do something about it? It does not mean that we don't follow the law, use the law to help beings who are in need of help, that we don't try to counteract abuse and protect beings in that sense. But in our own hearts, what are we doing with our energy, you know? You can free up a tremendous amount of time and energy by not feeding into those feelings of being offended. So anyway, just a very interesting little teaching there. Another quote from Shantideva, the great Mahayana poet, going back to some of the causes of wars, he says, wherever conflict arises among living creatures, the sense of possession is the cause. An interesting statement also, isn't it? Again, to me, this relates to possession of a self, you know. It's me, mine, I have a right. And of course we have identities, we have to function, we have, but when you look at it carefully, even our identity is shifting a bit and changing, you know. So it's an interim identity in this life that's useful for what we need to do in this life, but it's not a concrete, permanent, eternal thing. So the possession is the cause, he says. Another very important teaching of the Buddha and so many great Buddhist masters is that it's very important to take care of the people who are needy in one's society. You know, Buddha gave many teachings on this and many parables that he and from his past lives as well. Often wars start when there's a lot of poverty in a country. Possession is an important issue, you know. If there's such a serious inequality of wealth, perhaps, and of basic needs, there's going to be trouble, you know. So that's always something to look at, to take care. The greatest rulers who followed the Buddhist teachings always set up places of rest and nourishment and refreshment and medicine and so on in their cities, on roads that people traveled in their countries. And this was seen to be an important aspect of you know, living the Buddhist life, living, preventing war in their countries. Yeah. So, and then within our own hearts, you know, just looking at how our own sense of possession of things and ideas, actually even more so, can bring us into conflict with others. The fourth characteristic of existence, I'm going to quote this because it's not always mentioned, but I think it's really important, especially in our tradition, and that is nirvana. Nirvana exists. As the Buddha taught, there is an unborn, undying, unchanging, indestructible. And Reverend Master Jiu referred to this as the third position. So when we let go of the sense of a separate self, or at least of insisting on it, we enter into something unborn, undying, unchanging, which we realize is actually our true life. And within that, all things are resolved, things are fall into place. It doesn't mean we become gods and that we can solve everybody's problems. It just means that we can be truly at peace and fulfill our purpose for living. And so the training, in order to realize this and to keep this third position in mind, is Dogen is following Dogen's teaching, actually, and his rules for meditation, where he says, when the opposites arise, you have almost lost the way to salvation. So he emphasizes this very strongly in this is the very first thing that he wrote, Rules for Meditation, and again, a very, very important teaching for us. Look at when the opposites arise within the mind, i.e., this party and that party, right? We're all dealing with that. Or just in my own mind, you know, my virtues and my faults are at war with each other. You know, we can be at war with each other very badly and never experience peace and acceptance. Or just in our, you know, daily dealings with people, when we start to put people into, you know, when we start judging people and have fixed ideas about them and push them away, you know. Look at when we're creating opposites. And just to go towards the third position, go towards that, again, that stillness that takes us away from judgment, away from conflict, and helps us to have a greater view, you know, a bigger picture. We have to develop a bigger picture. As Reverend Master Jiu taught, that we are not God, or we're not the cosmic Buddha ourselves, right? And yet there's nothing within us that is not of the cosmic Buddha or God. So if that's the case, if we're starting to get into conflict with others, then we're actually fighting against an aspect of the cosmic Buddha or the unborn, if you think about it, you know, you can actually analyze these things somewhat and talk yourself out of a conflict. Well, I'm going to end with some teachings from another very great peacemaker. You've all heard perhaps of the Venerable Mahagosananda, who was a monk who, during the Khmer Rouge regime in Cambodia, he had to leave the country. His entire family were killed. And he had to go to Thailand and train for some time. And then towards the end of the war, he came back and went to the refugee camps and started teaching loving kindness because he realized nothing else was really working. So just quote a little bit from him, which is very inspiring. Apparently, he constantly reminded people that national peace can only begin with personal peace. In line with this, he held regular weekly meetings in refugee camps and so on for Buddhist, Muslim, and Christian section leaders, urging them to work together for peace and reconciliation. In April and May of 1980, around 120,000 refugees in this and another camp where he was were involved in each of 2 days of meditation and prayers for peace. Most were Buddhists, but Christians and Muslims were also involved. A prayer for peace, in quotes, which Gosananda has composed, includes these words, referring to Cambodia. We can actually refer this to ourselves too, though. The suffering of Cambodia has been deep. And I say that what I just said is because the Buddha often was very sympathetic to beings and said, you know, we've all suffered a great deal. We're here because we've got a lot of suffering under our belts from past lives. And now we have the good fortune to have converted that and come to hear the Dharma. So our suffering has been deep. From this suffering comes great compassion. Great compassion makes a peaceful heart. A peaceful heart makes a peaceful person. A peaceful person makes a peaceful family. A peaceful family makes a peaceful community. A peaceful community makes a peaceful nation. And a peaceful nation makes a peaceful world. This is his prayer for peace. May all beings live in happiness and peace. And then just a little bit more from his life. Later on, he was involved he went to UN-sponsored peace talks and so on. He led a contingency of monks and nuns and urged compromise and nonviolence. When people objected to having Khmer Rouge personnel, this is after the war, in an interim government, he smiled and said, these were their enemies, right? We must have both wisdom and compassion. We must condemn the act, but we cannot hate the actor. Again, this goes back to the sense of the teaching of no self. With our love, we will do everything we can to assure peace for all. For all. There's no other way. Related comments of his are, the unwholesome-minded must be included in our loving kindness because they are the ones who need loving kindness the most. If I am good to someone, he or she will learn goodness and in turn will be good to others. If I'm not good, he or she will harbor hatred and resentment and will in turn pass that on to others. If the world is not good, I have to make more effort to be good myself. He cites Gandhi, and he was a great fan of Mahatma Gandhi. He cites the Gandhian nonviolent ideal as aiming at an end to antagonism, not an end to the antagonists. This is important. The opponent has our respect. We implicitly trust his or her human nature, and as Buddhists we would say Buddha nature as well, and understand that ill will is caused by ignorance. By appealing to the best in each other, both of us achieve the satisfaction of peace. Gandhi called this a bilateral victory. I love that, yeah. And of course, he sees peacemaking as a slow but steady, step-by-step process. in this, Mahagosananda says, reconciliation does not mean that we surrender rights and conditions, but rather we use love in all our negotiations. Otherwise, there is no way beyond the cycle of hatred and retaliation. On unrealistic compassion, without wisdom, about that, he tells the story of a dragon king who came to give up killing. On being attacked by children, the dragon king was advised by a bodhisattva that, while remaining nonviolent, he could still hiss and show his fire if need be. I like that. Some very useful little teachings in there. So I'll finish up with that. These are just so helpful. If it's not too long, we're almost done. Gosananda teaches the importance of the middle path of and to peace, which avoids struggling with opposites, such as praise and blame, yours and mine, and so on. His thoughts on the path to peace also include, non-action is the source of all action. That's a big statement, isn't it? There is little we can do for peace in the world without peace in our minds. And so when we begin to make peace, we begin with silence, meditation, and prayer. Peacemaking requires compassion. It requires the skill of listening. To listen, we have to give up ourselves, even our own words. We listen until we can hear our peaceful nature. As we listen to ourselves, we learn to listen to others as well, and new ideas grow. There is an openness, a harmony. As we come to trust one another, we discover new possibilities for resolving conflicts. When we listen well, we will hear peace growing. Peacemaking requires mindfulness, in other words, careful awareness of the inner and outer world. There's no peace with jealousy, self-righteousness, or meaningless criticism. We must decide that making peace is more important than making war. So, interesting, each of us actually has to make that decision. You know, it's not for somebody else. Peacemaking requires selflessness. It is selflessness taking root. To make peace, the skills of teamwork and cooperation are essential. There is little we can do for peace as long as we feel that we are the only ones who know the way. Does that sound familiar? We can all apply that. Yeah. A real peacemaker will strive only for peace, not for fame, glory, or even honor. Striving for fame, glory, or honor will only harm our efforts. Peacemaking also requires wisdom. Peace is the path that is chosen consciously. It is not an aimless wandering, but a step-by-step journey. Peacemaking is the middle path of equanimity, non-duality, and non-attachment. Peacemaking means the perfect balance of wisdom and compassion, and the perfect meeting of humanitarian needs and political realities. It means compassion without concession, i.e., not giving up on compassion, and peace without appeasement, not just pleasing others, but really true peace. Loving kindness is the only way to peace. So I will leave you with those inspiring thoughts on this Memorial Day as we honor those who've died and all those who are also working to create peace. And we'll all join in with that good work. Thank you for coming today. Homage to the Buddha, homage to the Dharma, homage to the Sangha.